Very
Anyhow,
nice.
we are just past 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to, as usual, mute all. Everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, or use the chat window. And please remute yourself afterwards if you do unmute yourself, so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website, so you can review all that material at your leisure. We have a good number of items on the agenda here for tonight, so I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Chris. And we're going to start off with a follow-up from one of the items we had last week, where we were looking at how to back up files from a phone or a tablet. And Harvey has a backup system of his own, which he wants to tell us about.
All right. Thank you, Alan. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
All righty. So what we're going to talk about tonight, of course, is this Android, the backup onto a flash drive. And what I thought I would do when I was researching this, one of the objectives I thought was to use the Android device, but have the app on there and don't use a computer or a PC or anything like that. So this app that's on all Android phones or tablets is called Files by Google. And when you look at the icon, it'll just be titled Files. Anyway, there's four main components there for this. One is for file browsing, and that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And that will allow us to go in there and copy and move things and do all kinds of different things. The other one is media consumption, which is, playing and using various media formats. There's a storage cleanup, so you can go in there and delete files that you don't need. And last but not least, there's the offline file transfer, and that requires, let's say, two Android devices, each running the Files app, and then you can then connect and share files back and forth. So we'll go on to the next slide, Alan. Can
There
you
we
get
go.
there we go. All right, so what I did is I took a screenshot. Now, if you did start up the Files app, this is what you would see. Now, at the very top, which I had to cut out, that's where they accumulate and display what they call the recent files or images that you were looking at. And it takes up too much room, and there is no ability to remove that. So what I did was we just chopped it off. But this is what you see when you start up the main screen. We can see the various categories of files on your phone. The collections area, I didn't research at all. At the bottom, you can see where it's got internal storage. So if you did click on that, you could see all of those files. And then the other storage relates to like browsing in cloud. I didn't do much research in that, but I suspect that, we can go to Google Drive and that type of thing. All right, on the next slide. What we're going to do at this stage is we want to connect the USB flash drive to the Android phone. Now, if you have a USB flash drive that has a C type plug-in, then you can plug it in directly. I don't have a flash drive that is a C. I have the USB-A. So what I had to do is I had to use what they call a USB on-the-go cable. One end is a USB-C, which I plug into the phone, and the other end is a USB-A for which I can connect my USB flash drive. So at the bottom of the screen where you see Cruiser Glide, that just happens to be the brand name of the flash drive that I was using. So that will just verify that you are connected into the phone with that flash drive. All right, we'll get on to the next screen. Now, when you start using that flash drive, you will be prompted, and it'll give files the okay to proceed to read and write files on the drive. So you have to allow for that. On the next slide. So what I'm trying to show you tonight is I'm going to go into the internal storage of the Android phone, and we'll have a look at the folders in there. Go ahead and throw the next slide up, Alan. Now, what I should have done, and I did not illustrate that you could choose multiple folders, but you can. So, for example, on this slide, we have a number of folders there. You could choose any and multiples that you wish, like documents, downloads, movies, music, that type of thing. And that will carry you through to copy it onto the USB. If you are using this process as, let's say, to back up the whole phone or the whole internal storage, you could do it that way too. What I would recommend, though, is that you have, let's say, a cycle of four USB flash drives. And if you want to back up your phone, let's say in week one or whatever the frequency is, choose the flash drive that's next in the cycle, plug it in, and then you can go through this process and then offload your files onto the USB. So the next slide, Alan. What I did only do for this presentation is I went into the pictures folder. You can see at the top of the slide, it says internal storage and the pictures folder is open. And these are the subfolders within there. And the one that I was interested in is the one called screenshots. So if we get to the next slide, we would then be prompted that we can say copy to, and that will then allow you to begin that. Next slide. And then you choose where you want to copy it to. So at the bottom, it'll show you, in this case, it shows my cruiser. So I click on that, and away we go. The next slide. So now I'm looking at the cruiser itself, and the folder that's on there is called screenshots, and that shows me all of the files that got copied over. So there you go, nice and clean. In thinking everything through, if you were going to use this app for a tablet, It should work fine because that app should be on the tablet. It's an Android tablet that should have that app. If you don't, you can always download it and install it. So there we go. That's it for tonight.
Okay. Thanks very much, Harvey. It's a pretty easy way to back up a whole bunch of stuff from your phone or tablet. Sure.
All righty. Thanks.
Okay, next up we had a question came in about updating the device drivers. This is on Windows. And the individual says that they don't know what to believe because they're running a Norton, I think, security suite. And Norton keeps saying that there are outdated drivers, and yet Microsoft says that drivers are updated automatically. So there seems to be some kind of conflict here in terms of the two platforms. But Norton, although you notice in your plan, it can't actually do anything for you in terms of these outdated drivers. Everything is X'd out. But if you were to supply them with dollars, like $51, it says, for the remainder of the term of your current subscription, so who knows how much it is every year, for $51 and change, they will just update everything for you and you won't have any problems ever again. So my thinking on this is that there's probably no issue. If you check Windows, generally you'll find that there's a list of updated drivers somewhere, which you may or may not have dealt with. For example, when I wrote this stuff up, I looked, and on one of my machines, there were 12 driver updates available for installation. And I'm running Windows 10. So in Windows 10, you go to Windows Updates, all optional updates, and look for driver updates. And if you hit the chevron, then you will get a list of updates. So here we are in Windows Update. You can see the link there, view all optional updates. You need to look at that. When you do that, you'll see optional updates at the top here. But then here's that driver updates, and I've activated the chevron. And you can see I've got a whole bunch of driver updates available to me. I can check them and install them if I wish. Now, the process is slightly different in Windows 11, and Chris has Windows 11 and can comment on it.
Yeah, it's not that difficult to find, but it is different steps you go through. So when you run the Settings app, and at the bottom of the list will be Windows Updates, and then you click on the it's too small on my screen to see it. Driver Updates is in the Advanced Options, so you click on the Advanced Options next, and then you get another one that has Driver Updates specifically in that optional update, so you click on that, and then you'll finally get to the list of driver updates that are available on your system. And you can see on here I had one update that was actually available for me on that. I do think it's worth noting on that, I think it's on Windows 10 now as well, but definitely on Windows 11, you have a checkbox there saying that you can also install a cumulative update preview. And there will sometimes be other update previews, mostly in the .NET stuff. And I highly recommend that you don't choose that. Do you really want to be a guinea pig on that? These are non-critical updates in that they're not being, not fixing things that are exploits in the wild or anything like that. They will get rolled into the next patch Tuesday. And so, you don't know what is being fixed in that. And their early adopters are the only ones that are actually seeking that out and getting it. I would prefer to let somebody else be a guinea pig, and if there's a problem with the particular update, maybe it'll get fixed before the next patch Tuesday, and I won't have problems on my computer. So I really suggest that you don't take any of the optional preview updates that they actually offer to you.
Yeah, and you can save yourself some time from downloading and installing them too. You'll get them eventually, so...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so just in general, you'll note that both systems say that if you have a specific problem, one of these drivers might help. So the question I say is, well, do I have a specific problem with some driver? And personally, I don't, so that's why I didn't enable any of these driver updates. Now, that's not to say that they're not useful sometimes, and I have had a display driver problem which did get fixed by an updated driver. So it is useful to know where these things are and how to get to them if you wish. Anyway, the other thing that Bob Harris had told me to do was to check with a guru, a source, and Perplexity AI. So I went to Perplexity and asked it. I said, Norton says my drivers are outdated. Do I need to update them? And the response came back, I don't know where, I didn't check the references where these things came from, but it's very anti-Norton and basically says that Windows Device Manager is generally more reliable than things like Norton. And the notifications by Norton are often part of an upsell strategy. Remember that $51 and change? Updating drivers unnecessarily can cause instability and compatibility issues. Windows Update is the safest and most reliable way to keep your drivers current for most users. And for specialized hardware, check the manufacturer's website for updates. And then finally, many IT professionals consider Norton to be overly intrusive and potentially harmful to system performance. And then the final thing, in conclusion, they say, basically stick to Windows Update for driver updates, and only do it manually if you've got issues, and consider using Windows Defender, which is the Microsoft antivirus product, instead of Norton, as it's generally considered sufficient for most users. And I've been using Defender for a number of years, and it's worked just fine. So those are my thoughts. Now, Chris has a similar take, shall we say.
Yeah, I have a bit of a problem with Norton's advice, especially seeing as they want extra money for it. So, you know, if we go back to that original screen, Norton did identify that there are new drivers available for, in this case, sound, both input and output. And I don't doubt that that is true. You know, they're not lying about that. But then they have Norton saying that, you know, not updating these drivers can make PC crashes, freezes, and bugs more likely. I think that is, at best, disingenuous and probably way over the top to say that not updating the drivers is going to cause you these sort of problems. And then they had another risk of not updating it, that you would have poor sound quality. And I feel that is disingenuous and over the top as well. Personally, I think if your sound is working fine, don't worry about it. If you are having problems with sound, you know, certainly updating the drivers would be something that'd be you could try to see if it fixes your problem. And updating drivers like that probably is not going to hurt. I also think it's a little bit over the top to say that unnecessarily updating drivers is, you know, may cause problems on your computer. Well, updating any software on your computer potentially can cause you problems. But drivers are playing really close to the core. And so if they are going to cause problems, they certainly do have the potential of causing, you know, considerable problems. So there is something to be said for that. But I don't really worry too much about updating drivers one way or the other. I don't really seek them out an awful lot, but I don't necessarily avoid them. Video drivers in particular, I think, are worth updating frequently because of performance more so than anything else. And the major video drivers, I've got NVIDIA cards, and there's new updates out every month. And I'll usually go ahead and do them because they usually do end up with performance benefits and things like that. Other drivers, I usually don't really bother with. And I think in all likelihood that you'll find that Windows Update will offer you drivers where they've gone through quality assurance checks with Microsoft as well. And I think that they're pretty safe to do. Now, having said that, we did have an update from this person saying that they checked in Windows Update and there was one update which was not related to anything that Norton had actually identified, which was kind of curious. I think in particular that would point to the fact that these are not really important driver updates that Norton has identified. And so I certainly wouldn't pay money in order to be able to update them. So that's my take on it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And actually, the next question that came in is for you, I believe.
If okay,
I can get
yeah.
a slide to change.
Yeah.
There we go.
So this came in, and a person sent it into the suggestion box at opcug.ca, wondering whether they had gotten their phone hacked. So they sent out texts to a few people. And I take it this was nothing new, sending texts to these particular people. Two of the three recipients said that the message had all kinds of these question marks peppering in through the message. And they said that it never happened before. And how do they go about determining if there's malware or something on the phone that is causing this to actually happen? Next. So I think really what it comes down to is that it's a translation issue. It's a PCs and phones and so forth, they can use different character sets. And if you mix and match what you are sending a character set and the receiver doesn't have the ability to decode that character set correctly, they end up getting these question marks on, characters that don't exist in the character set that they're actually using. The trouble is trying to, figure out where the exact problem lies in order to fix it. I don't think it's that phone's been hacked or anything, but fixing this sort of problem can be a little bit difficult. As noted on the slide here, you can have emojis that aren't supported by the recipient device. They'll appear as question marks. Line breaks, returns your messages may be interpreted wrongly. It comes down to not only the devices, but the carriers could actually be at issue as well. I don't think so much network problems, but carrier settings could cause that sort of problem as well, where you'll get something garbled in the transmission. Next. So some of the possible solutions, certainly always checking to see that you're on the latest version of whatever operating system and the messaging apps to make sure that you're on the latest up-to-date where it's more likely to have the character support that is required. If you're on an Android device, if you go to the messaging app settings, you could possibly change the input mode to automatic if it's set to something very specific, and then it will try to interpret the incoming stream and select the right character set to use. Check and update your carrier settings. Now, I'm not sure exactly how you would actually do that, which can affect how the messages are encoded and transmitted. You might be able to check with your carrier and see what they have to advise on that. You could avoid trying to use any special characters. Now, in many cases, if you've chosen or if your device is using a specific character set, you might not even realize it. And so, unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult. If you are using a character set, it could be just, a capital letter A, but because the character set you're using, it just doesn't get interpreted properly, even though it looks just like a regular character A to you. But you could try to avoid any sort of complex formatting that might go into that app that you're sending the data through, and it might avoid using a character set that supports that particular character. They say stick to the basic GSM-7 character set, which is just the Latin alphabet, common symbols. You don't get accented characters. You don't get special symbols and things like that if you use that. But it's more likely to be interpreted by the other end without any difficulty. If you have to use characters that are outside of that character set, consider using Unicode encoding if you understand what that means. Quite frankly, I don't know how I would go about doing that. If you're experiencing issues specifically with messaging, SMS or MMS, then you could contact the device manufacturer or the carrier to see if they have anything that can actually advise you that might cure the problem. If anybody else has some ideas on that, I mean, I feel a little bit out of my depth to comment on that even at that level. That was just some advice I found online. If anybody else has run into this sort of problem, speak up or throw it into the chat and join the conversation.
I just looked into my Pixel, and in the settings for the Messages app in advanced, there is a use simple characters, which I presume just means the ASCII characters at a guess.
Yeah.
But that might be an option to try out.
Yeah, that sounds a good idea, Tom. So, yeah, if your phone has the ability to do that, go for it. I mean, if you're in a messaging app, you know, typically you don't want all kinds of special characters anyways. It's just plain text that you're sending to other people. So use simple characters in the settings for the messaging app. Sounds like a good thing to try. Thanks, Tom.
I think you can tell the age group we're talking about, people who don't use emojis. Actually, I have this problem occasionally between Windows and Linux, just exchanging document files. Occasionally, there'll be translation errors because they're using different coding sets and one doesn't translate the other. But it's very infrequent for me. Okay, thanks. Thanks for that, Chris. Moving along, we're always interested in people's apps, like the Files app that Harvey was talking about. And we've done a lot of Android type apps, but we also like applications for PCs. So you can talk about a smart app, or you can talk about a smart program. I came across this program recently called Uninstaller, and you notice it's spelt with one L. And it's kind of interesting. And when you look at the information, the developer says that it's easy to use and it's very accurate. So I was kind of interested, what the hell does very accurate mean when it comes to software uninstallation? Well, they say the features include a deep analysis of the data related to various applications. It will fix incorrect data, which I suggest may be a bit of a stretch. We'll come back to that in a second. Yeah, one of the interesting things, it detects previously uninstalled software leftovers. And I was intrigued by that one. It will batch uninstall. So if you have to get rid of a whole bunch of apps at once, this will do a perfect job for you. I generally only uninstall one app at a time, so that's not usually a concern. And one of the nice things, when you choose which apps you want to get rid of, it gives you a whole bunch of information about them before it will actually delete anything. You have to confirm that, yes, all this information is fine and I want you to go ahead, essentially. There are two versions of the program. There's a portable version, which is basically just a Windows executable file, so you can install that on a computer, or you can run it from a stick on multiple computers. And when you're finished, you can get rid of the file or just leave it there for next time. Or there's a more conventional program where you actually install the software on an individual computer and run it from that computer. And then you would uninstall it if you needed to, generally. I don't think it uninstalls itself, but you can uninstall it through Windows. So when you first start the program up, it does indeed take a couple of minutes thinking, and the little window goes round and round. And it's doing this analysis of the data, I guess. And then when it's finished, it generates an alphabetic list of all the applications which it found which were installed. And you notice on the left you've got the titles of them. And on the right you've got the actual file size. So you can see, you can check out for the big ones if you like. If you want to save some space, then you look for the huge installations and think about whether you really need those programs anymore. But you also notice in the top of the window there, you get a bunch of summary information. So on this particular system, it found over 300 applications. They're taking 33 gig of disk space, 780 files, etc., etc. And indeed, it took about just under 2 minutes to do the analysis and create this list. So as I say, you can go through this thing file by file, but you'll notice in this kind of menu bar here that there's some options. And you've got this option here that says show application types. And you notice that it has a whole bunch of things. There are various Windows type applications here. And then there's a whole bunch of data sources, platforms from which these applications could have been installed. For example, there's Steam, which is a basically a game platform. And then down here, there's portableapps.com. If you're interested in portable applications, then you can download those. And I don't know the others. And you can see I don't have anything filled out in most of these things. But you can filter, or you can go to individual categories and uncheck some of those and limit the list to things that you might be more interested in. There are some filters, and one of the filters is check by default, and that says don't list anything from Microsoft. So that prevents you from unintentionally uninstalling any software that's directly related to to Windows. And you can also choose applications that are 10 megabytes or applications that are in the last 7 days. And so it gives you some capability to do a little bit of filtering on the the list of applications. So I decided to look at, check that box that said Microsoft Store app, because I haven't installed anything, I don't think, from the Microsoft Store. I generally don't go there for my apps. And so you can see here it's listed a whole bunch of applications. And then by just clicking on the app, you can highlight which ones you want to be uninstalled. And so I've chosen Adobe Revel. Adobe Revel is an interesting one. It's a photo sharing cloud-based system, which Adobe quit supporting in 2016. There's an app there for eBay, there's an app there for Kindle, and there's an app there for Twitter. I don't use any of those, and I suspect that those are all apps that were bundled with Windows on the computer when I first purchased it. So I can check those four, and then I can go to uninstall. And so if I do that, then sure enough, I'm left with the four apps that I didn't select. Now, I talked about Microsoft Store, and these are all Microsoft Store apps in theory. However, you notice the first one, it's called Crash Data Retrieval 2. It's produced by Bosch, which is an automotive service company. And it's actually a program I use for motor vehicle safety research. This program is not in the Microsoft Store. So when they talk about fixing things which are incorrect in the listings, maybe they should take a look at this one, because I'm pretty sure that Crash Data Retrieval you cannot buy from the Microsoft Store. So how they got that wrong, I don't actually know. Anyway, the other thing I said I thought was really intriguing was this possible leftovers. So I go back to the show app types, and I click on the box for possible leftovers. I get a whole raft of these CCC help language type files, and this is something to do with an ATI video card or help files. And then there's other things like Clover and GoodSync and Composer, ShadowMaker. These are all programs which I have installed at some time or other, but I've decided that I wanted to uninstall them. And you remember, this is showing me possible leftovers. And the leftovers aren't huge, like some of my, Composer is 1 megabyte. Well, the file is much bigger than 1 megabyte. Similarly, InfraRecorder 7 kilobytes. So these are bits and pieces. They look as though they're bits and pieces of installation files that I want to install, and this is stuff that's literally left over, which I never even knew or existed. So kind of interesting to be able to uninstall all of those and free up some space. And you do get some warnings. Here I get a warning because I've chosen to uninstall Firefox, but I didn't choose to uninstall the maintenance service package for Thunderbird. Well, the reason I didn't want to do that, because I used Thunderbird, but I wasn't using Firefox on this computer. Anyway, there's a warning, so be well aware of what you're doing. And I said you get lots of information. So here's the screen where on this computer, it's generating information about all of these different these products here. And then you get a whole raft of information about where it lives and how many files there are, how many pieces of data there are, the registry entries, if that interests you. And as I say, you have to review all that and before you can actually start the uninstallation down here. So it's kind of interesting. It's easy. It's certainly easy to use, and it's fairly intuitive, I think. I didn't really have to read a manual to figure out how to run it. You just select the apps by clicking on them, the ones that you want to be installed. You will get some checks and warnings before you do anything. That don't include Microsoft Filter is useful, I think. I certainly left that checked. I found personally that those predefined platforms weren't useful because I don't use any of those things. But it did identify some bundled apps which I'd never used and had no interest in using. And it also found these leftovers that I didn't know existed. So that was quite interesting. And as far as I can tell, this thing is pretty easy and it works as advertised. And it gave me back, a few tens of megabytes of disk space. So that was fine. Okay.
Before you move on, Harvey asks, does an uninstaller create a restore point so that you can recover?
I shouldn't say it doesn't because I turned off at restore points on my machine, so it couldn't anyway. I don't think it does though.
Yeah, I suspect it wouldn't. Yeah.
Tom was asking for the link. It's right there. Uninstaller.com. 1L.
And that got pasted into the chat window at 7:56 p.m. as well.
Okay, perfect. All right, moving along then.
Chris. Just before we go on, Natalie asked, what's possible if you uninstall something that is related to another program and causes an issue?
Reinstall it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the fastest and easiest thing to do. You know, just reinstall the program. That should put everything back in place.
Yep, I've done that lots of times.
Oh, okay. Okay, so this was something I came across at the Thunderbird blog. So Thunderbird is a free email program that you can install on your computer if you don't want to do web-based mail. It's put out by the Mozilla Foundation. People make Firefox. And this caught my eye. Treat your email like laundry. And the highlights of it is they start off with this statement saying that if we ended up treating our laundry like we treat our email, at least 10 times an hour, we'd go look in the dryer, sigh at the mix of wet and dry clothes, wonder where the shirt we needed was, close the dryer door again without emptying a thing. And so I think that's the way a lot of people treat their email. And they have some pointers in there that take them or leave them, but they can help you keep things a little bit cleaner in your email box. So just some ideas, nothing earth-shattering on it, but I think worth checking out.
Yeah, I agree. I get a lot of email, and I delete a lot of email too, trying to keep the number at least manageable. Yeah. And I use folders for things that are important, I guess. Okay, I have a follow-up, but this follow-up is from a year or so ago, I guess. I did a presentation a while ago about plugging a USB drive, this is a micro USB, a thumb drive, into a Bell router. And of course, once it's in the router, it's on the network, so you should be able to access it. But the problem was the information provided by Bell was that you should use this My Network identity to access the thing, and it didn't work. So I had a problem, and I posed the question, how am I going to make this USB actually useful? And the answer, of course, was you asked the guru. And Chris said, well, the long and the short of it is, don't use network, use the actual IP address. So sure enough, if I go to Windows and I, in the search box, I type run, and that pops up the run app, and then I enter the // the IP address, and I also put in the /64GB nano, which is the name of the drive, and I say okay, then sure enough, it pops up this network share essentially, and you can see that there are three files in there, a couple of Canada Post documents, which somebody sent me way back when, and there's also a text file which tells me how to, reminds me how to set up this network drive now. So now I've got this kind of poor man's network attached storage system. I've got a USB drive which is on my router and is available to computers on the network. So I thought, well, most of the time I don't spend in Windows. How do I do this if I'm on Linux, which I normally am? So Mr. Google knows everything. And he says, if you go to Nemo, which is the file manager in Linux Mint, and if you type in the address bar SMB, which is for Samba, and Samba is a file sharing protocol or networks, and then again SMB colon, and now notice this time you have to use forward slashes in Linux. So slash slash, and then the IP address, and again the 64 gig nano, hit return, and it says, oh, authentication required. Well, I can just, by default, it's going to go as anonymous. I can just say connect. I don't need to enter any credentials because I haven't set up any security on this thing. As far as I'm concerned, it's just local to my local area network here, my Wi-Fi system, really. And so again, you can see on Linux now, this is Nemo. This is, this is Nemo, the file manager. You're looking at the USB drive over Linux, and you see again the two Canada Post documents and the text file. Now in Linux, you get bonus points. So, once you do that, it creates this desktop icon. So in future, I just need to click on this and I can access my nano drive on the router, which is kind of nice. So then the third thing I use is my phone. So how do I do this on the phone? I'm using Android 11, and I'm using a file manager called CX File Explorer. And this is a third-party product, but I really like it. It's nice and clean. It's easy to figure out what to do. And you'll see that there's a local tab and a library tab, which are the most of the files on your internal storage and your micro SD card if you've got one plugged in. It categorizes things by images or downloads and that kind of thing. But there's a third tab there, which is network. So if you click on network, then it asks you for a new location. So we click on new location, and now we get, by default, it will go to cloud, so it's looking for Dropbox or Google Drive or something like that. But I chose remote, and when I go to remote, I can choose Samba, SMB. So I choose SMB, I give it the IP address and the name of the drive. I click on anonymous, so I'm going to log in anonymously. No credentials. I just say okay. And there is my files. There are my files on the phone now in that 64 gig nano folder. So that's really quite handy. It means now I have a micro NAT, if you like, 64 gigs of storage, which I can access from my PCs, from my Windows, from Linux, and also from my Android phone and my wife's tablet. So we're in good shape in terms of swapping files here, there, and everywhere with pretty little effort on anybody's part. So if you have a router, you have a spare USB, that's kind of one use that you might think about putting that thing to. Okay, next up, pretty recent, I think, Chris, Ticketmaster.
Yeah, so we had a couple of emails come in to Suggestion Box about the Ticketmaster breach that occurred recently and some suggestions about that we warn people about it and some other remediation type operations that you can actually do for it. At first, we sort of dismissed it a little bit in that Ticketmaster seemed to be notifying all users that were affected. But then we started seeing some advice coming in from other sources that was going, let's say, a little bit beyond what Ticketmaster was actually advising people to do. And so we decided it was worth a share. So this was the official word came out that unauthorized third party obtained information from a cloud database hosted by a third party company, so they're blaming someone else on it. Between April 2nd and May 18th of this year. And apparently there are over 500 million Ticketmaster users that were actually affected. And they say may have included name, basic contact info, payment card information, not good, such as, and they say encrypted credit or debit card numbers. Well, you know, how good was the encryption and things like that as well, and expiration dates on those cards and so forth. So the question is, what should you really do about this? Next. So CBC had an article on it, and they quoted some things from Evan Light, who's an associate professor of communications at York, and he is apparently an expert in privacy and surveillance tech. And he said that, you know, if you get emails from Ticketmaster saying that you're among the accounts that were compromised, he advised to actually cancel your credit card right away. Now, I think that might be a little over the top, but certainly that would be the safest way to go about doing it. He suggested using the website Have I Been Pwned. Now, a note on this, the Have I Been Pwned website allows you to go in, put in your email address, and you can see if your email address showed up in any data breaches that have happened in the last dozens of years. And so it can be very useful, but personally, I think that the ship has sailed on this breach, because you can assume that your email address is in this Ticketmaster breach if you got an email from Ticketmaster saying so. So Have I Been Pwned is not going to give you any information that's new for this particular breach, but I do like the site, and I think it's really worth going to it and subscribing to it, and they will actually email you if your email address shows up in a new data breach somewhere. So it's definitely a worthwhile site. It's just not going to help you here. Evan Light also recommended enabling multi-factor authentication on credit cards. That's a little bit strange one to me as well, in that I'm not sure how I can do multi-factor authentication on a credit card. But if you know how to do it, that's not a bad idea for sure under any circumstance. They also suggested refraining from storing credit card information with the company you're buying from, even though it seems convenient. That's a little bit disingenuous as well, I think, in that if you're doing business with a credit, with some other company, and you're getting your credit card number to them somehow, they have your credit card number. You may have said don't store it, but do you have any assurance that they haven't actually stored it somewhere? Maybe they're just not storing it in a place that you can actually use it, but I bet you in a back-end system somewhere that, you know, that credit card is actually stored somewhere. Now, it may help, but I wouldn't necessarily count on it really helping you out an awful lot. Next. And then there was an article in Medium.com, which was a guy who, it seems like he has a bit of a thing on about any company that is involved in data breaches. He's really sick and tired of having to react to these things all the time. So he said that when it comes to Ticketmaster, he says, they don't care about you. They will not, as you know, they quoted, do everything they can to protect your data. He says, no, they won't. He says they'll do the absolute bare minimum to minimize the charges from the SEC in the States or any other regulatory bodies. That's all they're interested in, is not getting big fines. And he says you can't rely on them to protect you in any way at all. Next. So he has some other advice in that that comes into it. So he goes in a little bit more detail about what the breach actually had. It was pretty much the same as we saw before. Name, phone numbers, email address, home address, partial credit card details. I don't know what that really means. And he doesn't mention encrypted. And transaction details, which is important, because this is, they're going to have all of the details about the concert tickets and so forth that you actually bought. So he's afraid that people are going to receive follow-up calls, emails, letters, text messages, or whatever from the attackers that were involved in this breach. Remember, they have these 500 million users. They have all this information, and they're going to try and trick you into some kind of scam. So it can be really convincing, because they can identify the shows that you purchased tickets for. They have your name. They have the last four digits of your credit card information and so forth. So they can impersonate Ticketmaster to try and trick you into believing them something going forward. He suggests that you should not engage in any suspicious communications going forward, especially with Ticketmaster, even if they contain this information, because it could be the attacker who has gotten that information. validate the sender independently, verify communications you receive. So don't click on links in the email that comes supposedly from Ticketmaster. Emails can be spoofed. Email from addresses can be spoofed. So don't believe an email actually came from Ticketmaster. If you want to deal with Ticketmaster, you know how to get in touch with Ticketmaster. Go to them directly and find out the information you need. Contact Ticketmaster by going to their website and find their support page and get the information on how to talk to Ticketmaster. And definitely avoid clicking on any emails that have the same information that you provided to Ticketmaster. So your email address that you use when you bought tickets, if you get an email in that address, don't believe it. Don't click any links in that email. Next. And he had some additional suggestions. Change your account credentials at Ticketmaster. So go in, change your passwords, certainly. Remove any stored credit cards, which is probably not a bad idea either. But again, Ticketmaster actually has your credit card information, so I don't know if that's really going to protect you or not. He suggests to monitor your credit. And so in Canada, there's two credit reporting agencies, Equifax and TransUnion. Apparently, Ticketmaster is sending out that they will provide free credit monitoring, but they only talk about TransUnion. So they don't talk about Equifax. And so he's saying it's likely for Canadians not going to be enough to actually just have credit monitoring through TransUnion. He had a link to the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada, which has a lot of information about how you can monitor your credit. And then he pointed out to, I believe, their commercial offerings, Credit Karma and Borrowwell, that you could go to and look for additional possibilities when it comes to tracking your credit. So that's it for that. Now, if anybody else has any additional information to supply or ideas on how to react to this or any other data breach, by all means, chime in.
Tom has his hand up, so go ahead, Tom. You have to unmute yourself, Tom.
Still can't hear you. Oh, you're unmuted.
Louder.
Now you're muted. Now you're unmuted. We still can't hear you.
Interesting.
There's something wrong with your microphone there, Tom.
So there's a whole bunch of chat here, Chris.
Okay.
Natalie says she canceled her card, but they only informed her 3 months after the card was used on Ticketmaster as part of a breach.
Ticketmaster is being taken to task on why it took them so long to notify people, that's for sure.
Darlene says having more than one email is pertaining to online transactions with a company. Is this good practice?
I've heard that before where basically every site that you want to deal with, if you can create an email alias that you can dispose of at any point in time, that's not a bad idea. It's a little bit tedious to actually go through that. If you use National Capital Freenet and you can actually create endless email aliases, and so you can create these, you know, basically fake email addresses that point to your main NCF, National Capital Freenet mailbox. And so that, if you end up with something happening like this, you can end up just deleting that alias and poof, you won't get any other information coming through from that. So that's not a bad idea, but yeah, it is a bit of a tedious process to actually go through and to remember to do it every time you use some new service out there.
I was just going to say, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I was just going to say that it's not just you might not just get messages from Ticketmaster, but from a whole variety of either legitimate-looking or illegitimate-looking people, organizations that are using the information
good
from
point.
The Ticketmaster thing. So it's not just
messages from Ticketmaster. If anybody, if you're getting anything that seems out of the ordinary, or even things that are edgy, that seem that might be normal, be careful. The other thing I wanted to say, now that you bring it out, is that there is a DuckDuckGo has a temporary email that you can use, and it's very easy to set up. You load in the browser add-on or extension from DuckDuckGo, and then wherever there's an email entry, you can actually create an email there, an email that is unique that will be used, and then the email gets sent to you to your original address, which you register with DuckDuckGo, and at any time you can turn that off so that you don't receive any more emails from the organization that has that email of yours. So it's the DuckDuckGo extension, which also has a bunch of more bunch of other privacy enhancing things with it. But this is what something I use a fair bit.
Tom, you said that was a temporary, though?
It's permanent until you decide to delete it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good.
So
yeah.
It lasts forever.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's great then. Yeah, something like that could be very useful. As I say, a little bit tedious to keep it up to date and so forth. But if you're concerned about this, it does make it easy for you to discard that one alias, which if it gets, you know, if it was an email that was associated with a data breach, well, you know, who cares anymore? You know, they for at least for them being able to try and contact you by email to scam you out of further money and so forth.
It's
useful.
It's not actually with DuckDuckGo, at least it's not tedious, because you create the DuckDuckGo alias instantly. It only takes a minute or so to register with DuckDuckGo. And every email you get, it deletes the tracking, any tracking that they sent along with the email, i.e. the, you know, one pixel pictures. And it gives you a link to actually turn off the email. So yeah. It's very, very unheavy.
What I mean by it being tedious is that every service that you go to, so say you were a new customer to Ticketmaster or whatever, and they want an email address, well, you have to go create a new alias rather than just using your normal email address if you want this to be effective. So you want it that any future service that could be involved in a breach going forward, that the email address that you give them is a unique email address for that particular service. So you would have to create a new alias every new service that you go to. It's not hugely difficult. You just have to remember to do it and record, you know, what is this email alias that you created. So it might be something like, if I normally would use, chris.taylor@opcug.ca, I might use an alias chris.taylor.ticketmaster. Or something like that, or just TM, or something like that, for that particular service.
Well, I find
it's tedious the 48th time round, isn't it?
Sorry?
It's tedious the 48th time you have to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And you start to get sloppy, and you decide, I won't bother. And then it turns out that they get involved in a breach, and then you're back to square one on it.
Well, I don't find it tedious at all. The only tedious part of it that I can imagine is that if there's a password associated with that email, then you have to keep track of that separately along with the particular email you used and I guess the the company. So you might want to put that in your KeePass, for example, or Bitwarden or whatever. But I don't find there's any downside to using an address, because it's there at a click of a button, and it's not it takes maybe microsecond or two.
There's an interesting anecdote here from Allison. She says she got the email from Ticketmaster, and they're giving a 1-year subscription to TransUnion, which she already has from another breach.
Will they delay the implementation of it until the first one expires? And then
Darlene wants to know, She only ever bought tickets once in February of this year. Does that mean that she's less risk of compromised information?
No. If you used it once, then you're at risk. So as long as you're within that breach period where they said was, I forget what the dates were, back in March or whatever, or April, if you had an account with Ticketmaster at that point in time, then your information is at risk. On the other hand, B says, dumb question, but if you never use Ticketmaster, is there any chance that there would be a problem? No. This was a breach at Ticketmaster, and so it's only information that they had. I've never bought anything at Ticketmaster, and so they do not have an account on me that the information could have been compromised.
You can tell Chris doesn't take me many places.
Hey.
But that Ticketmaster thing, I think even if it got hacked between February and March, if you had an account on it, period,
yeah,
it'd be hacked. No matter, even if you haven't used it in a while, you're still going to be hacked no matter what.
Yeah,
until they have, if they had some time limit for an inactive account, then they might remove it themselves.
Yeah,
but don't trust that. Just say, anytime you open an account, it could be hacked.
Yep.
No matter when you open it.
Exactly.
Well, by the way, it's not just Ticketmaster, because Ticketmaster actually absorbed a number of other companies along the way to becoming Ticketmaster.
True.
So be careful.
Yeah,
any account.
I'm talking about being careful. Natalie reminds us that she added alerts to her credit card account, which Chris mentioned sometime before.
Yeah,
and
if I have a...
I think that's a really good thing to do.
Yeah, if I have a credit card charge of a dollar or more, usually within minutes of a charge going on my credit card, I'll get an alert on it, either email or text message, depending on the card. So that's really handy to be able to react quickly if you have something going on to your card that's suspicious.
But I always worry that now I have all this credit card information and banking information in my email.
Why would it be in your email?
Well, because you just got an alert.
Oh, no, they just tell you that. I get an alert just saying that there was a charge on your credit card. And
Tells you the amount of the charge.
Yeah. But
it also tells you something else. I can't remember. Just a sec.
Yeah, actually,
it'll tell you the amount of the charge
and where
the
was.
First four numbers and a few other middle numbers.
Yeah.
The card and who it was charged to and the amount.
Yeah.
So is that not risky to have all that information in your email? And how do you get rid of it so nobody can see it later?
I just delete them, if it's a charge that I legitimately made, I don't care, so I just delete it. I don't think there's anything in the information there that I'm particularly worried about. It doesn't include your credit card number or expiry date or anything like that.
Part of your number.
Wouldn't
you
just...
And then three numbers in the middle.
That's weird.
Yeah, my alerts, I don't get anything about my card information.
Oh.
My alert, and I guess this could just be dependent upon the card issuer. What I guess I would be concerned about, is there enough of the number that would uniquely identify it? Could it be used for fraud, those numbers? Or is it just, it's not of great concern. They need more than that in order to actually make an unauthorized purchase, is, I guess, what the point would be. And I guess if there was enough, like if it really uniquely identified your card, then I would stop those alerts probably. But in my case, I don't get that.
It's missing nine of the numbers, but it has eight of the numbers, but it's missing nine of the numbers.
Yeah, I don't know. You could talk to your credit card company and ask them about, how you know, is that enough information that an attacker would be able to use that to make an unauthorized charge on your card?
Right.
Yeah, a couple of people are saying that their alerts only have the last four digits. So if you're getting lots of numbers, I think I'd be complaining to my financial organization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Natalie had an interesting thing here. Reminder that if you replace your credit card, you need to update it with any automatic payments that get charged to your card. In my presentation on keeping passwords safe, I highly recommend that you use, first off, you use a password manager. And one of the entries in your password manager should be for your credit card, and it should list all of the places that you use automatic payments so that if you do have to replace your card, you just go to that entry and you go down through the list and you go to each of those sites, update the credit card information. If you don't do that, it is really easy to forget some charge that just goes on once a year or something like that for some subscription. And if you have that in your password manager, it's very easy to go through that list and update all of the places where you need to.
Okay, good discussion, and we're slightly over time, but I think everybody's interested in what we're doing. The last slide I have here is from AI guru, and he poses the question, how much should you tip an AI bot if it gives you a great response? And I guess the answer is for the techies in the audience here. But you might realize that 1010 is actually binary for 10%.
Give it an extra 100 volts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we don't have time for more questions, but we have lots of time for your questions next week. Our next Q&A session will be on Wednesday the 17th. So if you have questions or if you have topics that you'd like to share or topics that you'd like to follow up on from tonight, like credit card numbers and alert systems and that kind of stuff, just send us the details, some brief details, the suggestion box, and we'll add you to the agenda. So I hope everybody enjoyed what we had tonight, and great discussion. Thanks to all the presenters, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.